It's great to be at this small, rather informal workshop instead of some massive meeting. So I'm going to speak on a subject which is overlaps significantly with the talk by Eric yesterday. And in fact, if Eric hadn't talked yesterday and I had talked yesterday instead, I might have stolen his talk. but that's okay. I mean, I will talk about things which are complementary in some sense to what he was talking about. But it will be as narrowly focused in the sense of focusing almost entirely on a very small section of the theory, which of course is much much richer than anything I'm going to talk about. So, does this thing work? No, I want to change the.
I'm not sure that works for changing.
Ah, okay. Well, I'll use my fingers. It's okay. I just can't read the text.
You have to touch something.
Yes.
Oh. You think that will work? Oh yeah. Oh, something happened. Introduction. Oh, now.
You have to press some button.
Yeah. No, I understand that. Right. Let's see if that works. Oh, it works. Good. So now I can stand over here. I'm going to talk about various things. What I was going to talk about at the beginning was surveying results in perturbation theory, in closed string perturbation theory, but that was done by Eric yesterday. And so I'm going to rapidly go through, just to remind you of a few of the points he made yesterday. That's part of the whole story that I want to talk about. But I want to talk not so much about the perturbative parts of the theory as the as features of the complete non-perturbative structure of the theory in the low-energy approximation. So we're again talking about the alpha prime expansion, or the low-energy expansion of the string theory. And the things that will arise will be, there'll be various detective arguments rather than proofs of structures which arise in the theory at various orders in the low energy expansion, which are fascinating for all sorts of reasons, but they seem to have some sort of interest in mathematics as well as in string theory. And at the end, if I get to the end, I will make some comments about the relationship between what I'm talking about and the analogous calculations done by heroic figures in supergravity, doing multi-loop calculations in supergravity, and where there's an issue about whether or not the theory has ultraviolet divergences. And the question that I'll be addressing is to what extent one might hope to see such a signal of such ultraviolet divergences within string theory, which is, of course, ultraviolet finite. This is a sort of collection of topics based on papers with a variety of people. Most notably in the recent past, Eric, who's in the audience, Pierre Van Hove and Stephen Miller, who's a mathematician from Rutgers, Carlos Maffa and Oliver Schotterer in the audience, and I've got a complete monopoly on Rousseau's. I suspect there are no others, and Boris Piolin and Don Zeggier. So let me begin with some comments about the low energy expansion in string theory. So as we all know, the leading term is in the low energy expansion corresponds to supergravity, which can be described in terms of an action, the Einstein-Hilbert action, together with all sorts of other fields that make the theory supersymmetric. And then there are higher order terms which involve higher derivatives. So for example, the next term in the maximally supersymmetric version of the theory, which is what I'm going to be talking about, has an r to the fourth, which will generically be multiplied by some coefficient, which is a function of the moduli or scalar fields in the theory. And so this is a term of order alpha prime cubed relative to the lowest order term, and then there's an infinite succession of higher order terms. So this is an expansion in powers of derivatives, which means in practice powers of curvatures or covariant derivatives. The kinds of interactions that arise that I'm going to be talking about, although I won't be talking about all of them, start with this r to the fourth term, which has some dimension, and this is a plot of higher rising dimensions. So you get derivatives on r to the fourth, higher numbers of derivatives, and that goes on forever. The ones which are colored mauve are ones which in some sense, and I don't want to be too specific, especially in view of the discussion yesterday after Eric's talk, in some sense these are protected. These are, at least intuitively, BPS interactions, and precisely where the BPSness stops is a matter of debate, but at least the ones I've shown in mauve are ones which I think are indisputably, in some sense, protected. And then, of course, there are interactions involving more curvatures, which would contribute to the higher point function. So the ones at the bottom, though, are the ones which contribute to the four-point function, four graviton amplitudes, for example. These higher ones will contribute to higher point functions about which something is known, and I assume something more will be said tomorrow in a talk by Oliver Schotterer. There are, in the string theory, there are interactions which arise which don't have any correspondence with objects in supergravity because they violate the U1 symmetry, which is preserved in supergravity, which I'll say a word or two more about in the next transparency. So there's a variety of interactions which violate the U1 charge conservation by a certain integer, actually an even integer number of charges, and about which something is known. But I'm going to say in this talk, I say rather little about it.
But they're related by supersymmetry to the R to the fourth?
They're related by supersymmetry to R to the fourth, yeah.
So the ones in between must violate the U1 also, don't they?
The ones in between?
You don't mean that only the last one.
Oh, no, sorry, I meant the whole of that axis. That's meant to be an axis perpendicular to the R to the fourth. So at the same order as R to the fourth, there's a whole wealth of other interactions. And in fact, one of the challenges would be to write down in some neat way what the completion of the R to the fourth interaction is. So even at order alpha prime, even at the same order in alpha prime as R to the fourth. They arrive at tree level. Yeah, I'll say a word or two more in the next transparency. Then the whole structure, of course, in string theory has some relationship via duality with 11-dimensional supergravity. And then I've been talking as if I was in 10 dimensions, but of course one can compactify down from 10 dimensions, and I'm only going to be talking about maximal compactifications that preserve maximal supersymmetry. So toroidal compactifications in which the duality group gets extended, the rank of the duality group is gets larger and larger as you compactify on a torus with higher and higher dimension. And in particular, if you come down to four dimensions, then you have the duality group is E77, which in its continuous form is the supergravity duality group. I guess this set of groups were first talked about by Cremer and Julien in the 70s. So in supergravity, one has this series of groups of higher and higher rank in lower and lower dimensions, and the moduli, or the scalar fields, parameterize a coset space, which is the which has the group G modded out by its maximal compact subgroup, and these are continuous groups. Whereas in string theory, even and tree level, which is part of the question I was asked. The continuous symmetry is not a symmetry in the theory, but it's broken by the fact that there are discrete identifications of the scalar fields. So all this is well known. The question is, does supergravity by itself make sense? And in particular, since it's strongly believed that these continuous symmetries are unbroken, at least for the maximal, for the highly supersymmetric cases, by quantum corrections, can one make sense of the theory in which the symmetries are continuous? But in any case, in string theory, the symmetry is discrete. It's broken. It's an arithmetic subgroup of this group G. And so the fact the symmetry is broken, the continuous symmetry is broken, means that in string theory, there's a rich dependence on the moduli, whereas in supergravity, at least to the extent that you can calculate things in perturbation theory, there's no dependence on the moduli because the theory is invariant under shifts of the moduli. So string perturbation theory is an expansion in powers of a modulus in the limit near a boundary in moduli space. In particular, in string perturbation theory as usually defined, it's an expansion in powers of e to the phi, where phi is a scalar field. And this is the standard picture for higher and higher genus surfaces and higher order in perturbation theory. And associated with these world sheets, there are discrete modular groups, for the torus is SO2Z, and then for the genus 2 case, which was talked about yesterday by Eric, it's SP4. Higher groups, I've added these quotations for the higher ones because I'm not sure, I have a question about that. Is it right to say that the integrands are invariant under SP2H?
Not exactly. They're invariant under a group that maps to SP2H.
Right. I see. Okay. No, does the issue of splitness or non-splitness of, are you allowed to say it's SP2H?
It has nothing to do with simple moduli. This is purely boson group thing.
Right. Okay. So, okay.
I would also say the answer to your question was no. There's a bigger group that maps to SP2H.
Right. Anyway, as far as what I'm going to say in this talk is concerned, I'll be focusing mostly on the SL2Z case, where SL2Z will make two appearances. So there's SL2Z here on the world sheet, which has a complex structure tau. So tau is a remnant of the world sheet metric, which is to be integrated over in calculating the scattering amplitudes. And that shouldn't be confused with the other SL2Z, which will come along in a minute, which is an SL2Z associated with the duality group, the SL2 duality group. And so it's easy to get confused. So tau is the world sheet parameter, and later on omega will be the target space parameter. So the question that I'm addressing is to what extent we can make statements about the exact non-perturbative structure of the theory. In other words, to what extent can one understand the exact moduli dependence of the terms in the low energy expansion, and in particular in the low-lying terms, simply because those are the ones about which one has a hope of making other simple statements. Now, the duality, the S-duality, or the non-perturbative duality, relates the theory in different regions of moduli space, and in particular, it therefore connects perturbative and non-perturbative features of the theory, and indeed, that means that different orders in perturbation theory are connected as well. So I'll be talking almost entirely about, until towards the end of the talk, I'll be talking about the theory in 10 dimensions and the type 2B theory, which is the simplest prototype for what I'm talking about, where there's simply one modulus, a complex scalar, and omega now is the modulus, as opposed to tau, where the imaginary part of omega is the inverse of the string coupling constant. And the duality group acts on omega in the standard way. A, B, C, and D are integers. And this is the analog of what I was saying before about the world sheet. So this transformation relates strong and weak coupling. So I'm going to be talking about the four graviton amplitude almost entirely. At this point, I'm going to repeat a little bit of what was said yesterday. The amplitude, with this much supersymmetry, can be written you can pull out a factor of r to the fourth outside it, where r is the linearized curvature. So it describes the polarizations, epsilon, of the four external particles. St and u are the Mandelstam invariants defined with a certain normalization. And the amplitude in general is a function of the modulus, omega. And t is a scalar function. It's a symmetric function in ST and U because of Bose symmetry. And in fact, it's easy to show that it has that the analytic part of T has a power series expansion in powers of ST and U, which are contained within these combinations sigma 2 and sigma 3. So the most general power series expansion for T is in fact a power series in sigma 2 and sigma 3 indexed by two integers, P and Q. So the coefficients in that power series I'm calling capital E, or epsilon, and they are labeled by P and Q, and they're functions of omega. So the challenge is to find out what you can about the exact form of these E's, these coefficients of the different terms in a power series in the Mandelstam invariants. At this point, I decided to get rid of alpha primes. They're absorbed. Well, you can either say that I've set alpha prime equal to a particular value, or I've absorbed it into the definition of ST and U. So a power series in ST and U is an alpha prime expansion. I'm ignoring the fact, of course, that there are very important non-analytic pieces in the amplitude. In fact, the whole structure in the field theory, what you see are the non-analytic pieces, the threshold terms. I will say something about those later if I have time, but there is there's an interrelationship between the non-analytic and the analytic pieces, which is clearly very deep and important, and very confusing. But at the low orders in the expansion that I'm going to be talking about, there is a sensible way of separating the analytic and the non-analytic contributions. So let me talk about the analytic ones. And we want to determine these. And when we determine them, one of the boundary conditions we'll have in understanding the full non-perturbative structure is that they should reproduce what we know in various limits, and in particular in the limit of string perturbation theory, the limit in which omega 2 goes to infinity. We should reproduce what's known about string perturbation theory. So what I want to do is very quickly review, but I can do this incredibly quickly because this was done by Eric yesterday, what we know about string perturbation theory. And when I say what we know about it, what I mean is what we know very, very explicitly in terms of very detailed coefficients, which we only know, of course, at very low orders in the genus expansion, because not much is explicitly known beyond genus 2. So the first thing is, as described yesterday by Eric, the tree level amplitude is given by a ratio of products of gamma functions, and it's extremely easy to expand those. Here I've put alpha prime back, actually, just to illustrate that it's extremely easy to expand these to all orders in alpha prime using elementary properties of gamma functions. And the successive terms that I've written down, this of course goes on forever, correspond to these terms in some sort of effective interaction language. So the first term is the term that you would get if you're doing supergravity, the tree level supergravity term. And then the next term is the r to the fourth term, which comes with this characteristic zeta 3 coefficient. The next term is four derivatives on r to the fourth, which, and I'm not specifying here, of course, how the indices are contracted into each other, but that's very straightforward in these calculations. So there's a succession of terms, and I've stopped, I've ringed the first three, which are the ones which go up to d to the sixth r to the fourth, because those are the ones which I'm going to talk about more later on. But you can see that the general pattern, yes? The general pattern is that the coefficients are zeta value, powers of zeta values with rational coefficients. That's the general structure. These and at the level of the four-point function, you see zeta values to all. The whole series contains only powers of zeta values. There are no irreducible multi-zeta values, about which I will make a brief comment later. Yes.
So I was wondering if without doing the computation, any reason why these powers of alpha prime and other ones, for example, I see alpha prime square missing alpha prime to the fourth. I mean, this pattern is not...
Supersymmetry implied that the terms below r to the fourth are not present. D squared r to the fourth is absent for the four-point function because that would be proportional to s plus t plus u. D squared is s, and then by symmetry it's s plus t plus u, and that vanishes. The analog for the five-point function is r to the fifth. That also vanishes, and that's perhaps less obvious.
The tree-level coefficient of r to the fifth vanishes.
The tree-level coefficient of r to the fifth vanishes. I'd better check.
The
one loop.
And the one loop.
R to the fifth simply seems to vanish to all orders that it's been calculated at. Yes. That's a property of the closed string theory, is that it only contains odd zeta values. The open string contains both odd and even. And the projection that takes you from the open to the closed string, which in the language of the mathematics of multi-zeta values, converts the multi-zetas into, well, the multi-zeta value, Let me not get into it. I may say a word or two about it later. I've got a transparency about it. And I suspect, are you talking about this tomorrow? No. Okay. Well, I'll say a word or two later. But there is a projection that projects onto the odd Marti zeta values, which is the analog of the KLT projection, which takes you from open string to closed string. There's a one-to-one correspondence. So there's an infinite series of terms with this structure. Genus one, which was described in great detail yesterday by Eric, things get much more difficult because now you have to expand the loop amplitude, which itself is a functional integral over the torus, you have to integrate over the complex structure tau, but the thing you're integrating is itself an integral over the vertex positions of the exponential of the Green's function between any pair of vertices weighted with ki dot kj. So the alpha prime expansion involves expanding the exponential of the Green's function, which brings down powers of the Green's function. And then you have to integrate those powers over the torus. So here is a symbolic representation. Here, this is one of the terms. This is a weight W term in that expansion, and that has to be integrated over torus, and that gives some power of ST and U multiplying a coefficient function of tau, and this coefficient function can be expressed, as Eric described yesterday, in terms of Feynman diagrams on the torus, and then you're faced firstly evaluating this coefficient function and then integrating it over the torus to get some numerical coefficient for that order. And that was described in detail yesterday by Eric. This is just a summary of what you get up to the order at which we know things. And so I'm giving you these numbers not for you to remember them, but just to point out that they're going to reappear later in the context of the non-perturbative discussion. But at the moment, I'm just describing the string perturbation theory. And these are the coefficients. The first term here is the R to the fourth term, which is simply the proportion to the volume of the fundamental domain. The next term, in fact, vanishes, and that's a striking fact. This is a d to the fourth r to the fourth term. D to the fourth r to the fourth is supposed to be a quarter BPS, and the fact that the one loop amplitude vanishes for that contribution is presumably deeply related to the fact there are no quarter BPS states in type 2B string theory in 10 dimensions. As soon as you go to 9 dimensions, or the lower dimensional cases, which I'm going to hint at later, you find there is a non-zero one-loop contribution to the d to the fourth r to the fourth.
So only in 10 dimensions,
that's absent. It's only absent in 10 dimensions, yeah. I fear this pi should be there. You can write this in pi-less notation. So I think that pi is a mistake. There's a pi outside the whole thing, of course. So this is the d to the sixth r to the fourth term. And then this is the d to the eighth r to the fourth term. And that's vanishing, but you've got to be a bit careful with that one when I say it vanishes, because I've listed here the non-analytic pieces, which I'm not describing in any detail. But these are the other pieces of the amplitude which arise. And the first non-analytic term in 10 dimensions is something you can see in supergravity. If you look at supergravity, there's a pole in the dimensionally regularized supergravity around 10 dimensions, which gives an expression of this form. But then there are no more thresholds until you get to d to the eighth r to the fourth, or s to the fourth. And then you get the first stringy threshold. There's a very simple unitarity argument which shows that there must be a term of this form. Three powers of S bigger than this one, essentially because there's an R to the fourth correction in string theory.
When you call it a stringy threshold, you mean a stringy correction?
To the masterless, I'm sorry, yes. A stringy effect on the masterless threshold, the two-particle threshold. So genus two, this is, of course, was constructed explicitly originally. The amplitude was constructed by Doker and Fong, and then later Doker, Gutpern, and Fong looked at its low energy limit and the leading term of the low energy limit, and they found it this coefficient here. Then, as described yesterday by Eric, He and I, together with Boris Pioli and Roberto Rudolfo Russo, not to be confused with Jorge Russo, who also appeared on the first list of collaborators, we managed to calculate the next term by essentially, first of all, discovering that it corresponds to something that we call the Zhang Karazumi invariant, and then managing to integrate that object over the genus 2 moduli space.
At what point would you run into trouble with logarithms in that expansion?
With what?
Logarithms, thresholds.
You'd run into a genus 2, the same point as before, the d to the 8th out of the 4th.
Okay. So the next term after you computed.
The next term, yes. D to the 8th out of the 4th is the thing that causes all the problem. But the reason that the genus 2 and the genus 1 both come at the same point is that...
But the power counting you do with field theory is wrong.
Field theory, this is not a field theory effect. This is that threshold.
Yeah. In field theory, you would do some power counting.
Yes.
That would show that a two-loop effect, I think, would only give logarithms higher up. Maybe that's wrong.
The basic point is when you factorize if you factorize on the two particle, if you cut through the two particle threshold, and then one side you keep the supergravity tree, and the other side you have the four-point function, and that four-point function, it's the r to the fourth piece of the four-point function that contributes, and that has both a tree level and a one-loop term, which translates into a one-loop and a two-loop threshold. In we can talk about
supergravity. That wouldn't happen.
That wouldn't have happened at all. No. These are very different. Genus 3, as quoted by Eric yesterday, there is a numerical value that's been deduced by Gomez and Maffa. I don't know, is Carlos, are you talking about this?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. So in a rather heroic calculation, which finally got cured of a factor of 3, this is the numerical value for the low energy limit. This is really very difficult to extract. So all these numbers in mauve are ones which will arise again in a few minutes. And then at higher orders, essentially nothing is known, certainly nothing with any detail like this. Now, I'm inclined to skip this because maybe I'll skip through it just very quickly. At tree level, this has all been generalized to the endpoint function in a beautiful series of papers by various combinations of Maffa, Schlotter, and Steberger. Where the coefficients now for the open string case involve multi zeta values, which were defined yesterday by Eric, and I've redefined them here. They're multiple sums which generalize Riemann zeta values. And when you get to a high enough weight, which means the sum of the arguments is equal to 8 or more, then you get irreducible multi zeta values that can't be rewritten entirely in terms of powers of zeta values. In the closed string case, as this was what the comment was about before, you actually get ones which involve odd weights. So the projection on which gives you the closed string amplitude kills the even weight multi zeta values, and you're left with just odd ones at all orders. And these multi zeta values have very interesting, I'm told, mathematical connections. There's a lot of work by people in looking really at quantum field theory diagrams and renormalizable quantum field theory. Who are looking at the kinds of objects which arise at high orders in field theory, which involve multi-zetas and generalizations thereof, generalizations which may well be of interest in what I'm going to talk about in string theory. So the question is, how does it generalize to higher genus? And that might be something that Oliver will talk about tomorrow. So I'm going to talk about, having introduced the perturbative sector, let me now talk about aspects about the non-perturbative structure. So this is back to the formula, to the expression I showed before. What we want to find are what these SL2Z invariant functions are, the coefficients in the alpha prime expansion. And there isn't any very systematic way of doing this that I know of, other than, in certain elementary cases, using supersymmetry in a rather powerful but clumsy way, which I'm going to describe in outline in a second, or making use of the duality between M theory in 11-dimensional M theory on a two torus and string theory compactified on a circle, which I've decided not to describe in detail here because it's just, I haven't got time, but I will make a few comments about it later. So let me just talk about supersymmetry, and I'm not going to give any details, but the statement is that we're trying to find a higher order effective interactions, and so let me define an order alpha prime to the n interaction with some composite operator, some composite field P, which for example might be r⁴. That's got U1 charge 0. It might be something which carries U1 charge. In fact, the interaction which has maximal U1 charge is lambda to the 16, where lambda is a dilatino. Each lambda carries U1 charge minus 3/2 in my normalization. So this is charge minus 24. And there's a whole range of interactions. These are all at order alpha prime. These particular examples are at order alpha prime cubed. But they're, of course, arbitrary. You can go up to arbitrary powers of alpha prime. Now, associated with the fact that these interactions may transform non-trivially under the U1, because they carry a U1 charge, there will be a coefficient function which will not be a modular invariant, but will transform with a modular weight that compensates for the modular transformations of this bunch of fields. So the coefficient function in general will be a modular function that transforms. In the way I've set this up, it transforms with a phase. It's got modular weight U over 2 and, holomorphic modular weight U over 2 and anti-holomorphic modular weight minus U over 2. So it transforms by a phase, and that phase has got to be chosen to compensate for the phase transformation due to the U1 violation of this interaction. So the action at any order in the alpha prime expansion contains a sum over such terms. When you act with a supersymmetry, you want the action to be obviously invariant, but the supersymmetry the action itself is the sum of n of these terms, and the supersymmetry transformations will get contributions from every order in alpha prime as well, so that the complete supersymmetry transformation will be a sum of what I'm calling delta, where delta 0 is the classical supersymmetry, but then that gets corrected at every order in alpha prime, so that there is a sort of Noether-like procedure here, where you look at the corrected supersymmetry acting on the corrected action, and you want that to vanish. But you also want the algebra, the supersymmetry algebra, to close, at least on shell. That's what this tilde means. So up to equations of motion. So you want to impose these two sorts of conditions, the invariance of the action and the algebra. Imposing that strongly constrains, at least in the low order terms, strongly constrains the form of these higher order terms in the action and in the supersymmetry transformations. Now the supersymmetry transformation on any term of this form, the supersymmetry carries a U1 charge, of course. So what supersymmetry does is it mixes up terms which differ by 2 units of the U1 charge. So that in doing this, you end up mixing a charge. This simply says it's difficult to do. But for example, at lowest order, the zeroth supersymmetry transformation on the first correction to the action plus the first correction to the supersymmetry on the zeroth correction has to vanish. You have to impose that, but the supersymmetry will transform one term in the action into another term which has a different U1 charge. So this will mix the terms of different U1 charges. So at the lowest order, alpha prime cubed, you get this. There's another term at order alpha prime to the fifth, which I haven't written down, which has the same structure. And then something new happens when you get to alpha prime to the sixth. And I just wanted to stress that because later on you'll see a consequence of that. When you get to this order, then not only can you get a mixing of a new term in the action, S6, transformed by the classical supersymmetry, mixes with a sixth order term in the supersymmetry transforming the classical action, but you can also get an order alpha prime to the sixth term from the delta 3 variation of S3. so that you get this new structure. But anyway, going back to the simplest examples, and this is something I did with Sethi a very long time ago, the net result of this is very symbolically is that in imposing this condition, you end up with a set of linear of first order equations involving a covariant derivative. The covariant derivative has the property that it takes a charge U object into a charge U plus 2 object, and the D bar takes a charge U plus 2 into a charge U. And you get a set of equations like this, and with particular coefficients for these, depending on what the interaction is that you're talking about. So you get this tower of relationships between interactions which differ by 2 units in the U1 charge, but they're first order equations. But of course, if you iterate these first order equations, you get Laplace equations. So this leads to Laplace eigenvalue equations, which have this generic form here, where d bar d is a Laplacian acting on a charge U object, the way I've written it. But if you now look at the charge zero case, so I'm going back to R to the fourth, which is charge zero, then you get the standard Laplacian, which is defined here, acting on the zero charge object is some eigenvalue times zero charge object. And the two cases this applies to, which were actually mentioned yesterday by Eric Doerker, are the r to the fourth coefficient and the d to the fourth r to the fourth coefficient, which both satisfy equations of this type, one of them with s equals 3/2, where s is related to n. N is the order in the alpha prime expansion. So when n is, r to the fourth is alpha prime cubed, so n is 3, and therefore s is 3/2. And therefore this eigenvalue is 3/4. And then the next term is the order alpha prime to the fifth term, which has an eigenvalue of 15/4. These are examples of equations, as again mentioned by Eric yesterday, which have unique solutions, given the fact that we know that these functions are at worst polynomially power behaved in omega 2 at infinity, because that's the perturbative state, the boundary condition of perturbation theory. So I just want to say a few words about these Eisenstein series. So they're defined as double sums. I've normalized this in a different way from Eric slightly, for convenience. These are double sums over co-prime integers, P and Q, with omega 2 to the s divided by the modulus of P plus Q omega to the 2s. And writing it this way, this is actually equivalent to a Poincaré series, which is simply a sum over copies, SL2z copies, of the imaginary part of omega. Modded out by a parabolic subgroup. The parabolic subgroup of SL2 is simply the subgroup that translates you in tau 1, and you have to mod out by it because the thing you're summing doesn't depend on tau 1, and therefore you'll be overcounting if you didn't mod out by it. But this general structure is what will occur towards the end of the talk. This is the expression for the Eisenstein series, which naturally generalizes to the higher rank groups that you get when you compactify the theory to lower dimensions. And it's manifestly SL2 invariant, the way I've described it. And it satisfies this Laplace equation. Now you can look at you can analyze the Fourier modes of the Eisenstein series using this equation. And so it has a very simple Fourier expansion. The zero mode, the constant term, has two power behaved pieces, as again Eric pointed out yesterday. These are power behaved in the string coupling constant. So these will be interpreted in string theory as terms in string perturbation theory. Of course, I arrived at this Eisenstein series using supersymmetry and not by using string theory in any explicit fashion. So it's rather interesting to compare these power-behaved terms with what you actually get when you do string perturbation theory. Those are the zero modes. The non-zero modes are proportional to Bessel functions, K Bessel functions. And K Bessel functions have asymptotic expansions, which of course are well known. They behave exponentially. They decay exponentially with their argument at large omega 2. The coefficient, so they look like instantons, because these things come with a phase, which is also 2 pi. The phase is 2 pi k omega 1, and the exponent here is 2 pi k omega 2. So this looks like exactly what you'd expect from a BPS type instanton. with a very particular coefficient, which is a divisor sum. Sigma here is sigma n of k, is simply the sum over the divisors of k, p to the n. Actually, that should be, is it p to the n or p to the minus n? It doesn't really matter. So these have a very nice interpretation. The power behave terms have the nice interpretation of contributing to string perturbation theory, and the non-zero modes have the nice interpretation of having something to do with instantons. But this is for general S. Now you put S equals 3/2, and you go to you have to multiply by a power of the string coupling to go to from everything I've said so far is in Einstein frame. To go to the string frame to compare with string perturbation theory, you have to multiply by g to the minus 1/2. And there's a factor of 2 zeta phi in my normalization of the Eisenstein series. And then you find the power behave terms are simply characteristic of tree level and one loop and nothing else. And then there's an infinite set of d instanton contributions with particular coefficients. So this is the non-renormalization theorem that Eric was talking about yesterday. And then there's an analogous statement for E5/2. So there are no contributions to d to the fourth r to the fourth beyond two loops. These two statements are, at least in a qualitative sense, in keeping with what is found explicitly when people in supergravity do multi-loop calculations. You find, it's been known for a long time, that at one loop you get the leading low energy behavior is r to the fourth. At two loops, due to the work of Doper and Fong originally, it's known that the leading low energy behavior is d to the fourth r to the fourth. I'm sorry, that's string theory. In supergravity, it's another bunch of people who found that it's d to the fourth r to the fourth. And in fact, the next term, which will come up soon, is known to have, the phi loop term is known to have a low energy behavior, which is d to the sixth r to the fourth. But I'll say a word about that next. I've made the comment here that although I motivated these Eisenstein series using supersymmetry, you can arrive at them equally well by considering supergravity in 11 dimensions compactified on a 2 torus and using the dictionary between M-theory and type 2B string theory at the level of these quantum corrections to supergravity. And of course, that sounds sort of mysterious, and presumably the justification for why you get the right answer is to do with the fact that these are very highly protected processes. These are BPS processes, and therefore one presumably has the right to continue the supergravity approximation well outside the region where you would expect it to be applicable. But the reason for saying that is for the next term, which is of order alpha prime to the sixth d to the sixth r to the fourth, is this coefficient E naught one. That's really the only way in which, so far, the precise expression for this coefficient has been deduced. So this coefficient is very interesting because it's not an Eisenstein series. It satisfies this inhomogeneous Laplace equation. This was the case, remember, where from supersymmetry, you would have expected a mixing between the thing that did give the Laplace eigenvalue equation and the order, the alpha prime cubed variation of the alpha prime cubed action. And you can pinpoint this source term on the right-hand side as an effect of that. But getting the exact coefficient, to my knowledge, no one has deduced the coefficient exactly using that, although there are some hints at this equation coming out from recent work by some other people. So this equation has a very rich structure. And it was conjectured by looking at, it came out of this analysis of two-loop supergravity compactified on a two-torus, where the leading term is d to the fourth r to the fourth, and that gave the term I had on the previous transparency. But the next term, you expand to one order, you expand the supergravity to one order further in S, T, and U. But that's exactly what you do when you calculate this, the Zhang Kawazumi invariant in string theory is expanding to one order the genus 2 string theory amplitude. Here we're expanding to one order the two-loop supergravity amplitude. So we're looking, the supergravity, of course, in some sense, is the maximal degeneration limit of the genus 2 surface that you have in string theory. But here we're doing it in 11 dimensions, not 10. So were it not for the fact that we were doing it in 11 dimensions, we would in fact have been calculating the degeneration limit of the Zhang-Kawajumi event. And in fact, our calculation coincides precisely with that interpretation. But anyway, using that, we were able to end up with this expression for the coefficient of this term. Now, what I want to do is spend a couple of minutes describing solutions to this equation, because although we had this equation some time ago, it's only last year that, in collaboration with Stephen Miller, we looked at the complete solution of this, and it's got some weird and wonderful features. So we're trying to solve an equation of this form. I'm now calling the function f. This is the equation we're trying to solve, where this is the Eisenstein series squared. We did this in several ways, but the most straightforward way, certainly to describe, is to simply look at the Fourier series for f of omega. So f hat is the omega 1 Fourier coefficient, the nth Fourier coefficient. And then you can decompose the equation into a set of equations where you take the nth mode of the source term on the right-hand side, and you get ordinary second-order differential equations for f hat. You have to impose boundary conditions, of course, to look for the solution. The large omega 2 boundary condition says that f hat can't increase any faster than omega 2 cubed. In fact, for n not equal to 0, these f hats either decrease exponentially. You have to throw away the exponentially increasing solution. But then there's a rather subtle boundary condition that I won't discuss here. But basically, because the function itself has to be SL2 invariant, there is a condition at the origin for each Fourier mode, which requires it not to blow up faster than the second inverse power of omega 2. And that's a very strong condition, it turns out. That boundary condition turns out to be very strong. It uniquely specifies the coefficient of the solution to the homogeneous equation for any n has an arbitrary coefficient, alpha n, but that is completely specified by requiring this boundary condition at the origin. So in the end, the solution looks like this. The zero mode now has four power behaved terms instead of two, which all the Eisenstein series had. And they correspond, once you've gone to string frame, you have to multiply by omega 2 to the minus 1, and that corresponds to tree level, one loop, two loop, and three loop. And all these numbers, as is true, for the Eisenstein series, where we had a tree level and one loop piece, or a tree level and two loop piece, all of these numbers coincide with exactly the results that were calculated in string perturbation theory, including this genus 3 piece, which for some time there was a factor of 3 discrepancy with the work of Maffa and Gomez. But then there's an infinite set of non-perturbative contributions to the genus, to the constant term. And these have this structure. I've written it down exactly. It's a bit of a mess, but it's basically bilinear. It's a matrix. This is a matrix of coefficients multiplying ki or kj here are the k0 or k1 Bessel functions. So they decrease exponentially, and this term decreases like e to the minus 4 pi m. It's got no phase, and this is double the exponent of an instanton. So this is extraordinarily, it's very tempting to say that looks like an instanton anti-instanton pair.
How does this avoid being
By some magic. Now there's a phenomenal, so this looks very bad. So the reason I stressed before what that boundary condition is that at first sight this looks pretty bad, but if you add the if you fix those coefficients, so this is for the zero mode, so you only fix one coefficient. It's this sum which is exponentially decreasing at large omega 2. At small omega 2, at the origin, exactly cancels this omega 2 to the minus 3. And in fact, near the origin, I've got this on here, near the origin, this behaves exactly the way that we would have hoped. So when we saw, we were very puzzled by this. This boundary condition at the origin was sort of mesmerizing because we couldn't get it to work. But then we realized that we just weren't being smart enough to do this sum properly. And there is a beautiful cancellation which ensures that the behavior of the origin is correct. And that goes on for each one of the modes. So it's like a sum of an infinite number of instanton anti-instanton pairs, in some sense, near the origin, cancelling what would have been a bad singular behavior and giving a less singular behavior, which is reminiscent of things in Yang-Mills theory. It's reminiscent of other things. Actually, this is one of the reasons for talking about this is that I'm not 100% sure how to interpret this, but this is what happens. If I look at the non-zero modes, then there is these behave. These are suppressed exponentially. The behavior is specified by a pair of integers n1 and n2, which either have the same sign, and if they have the same sign, then the phase of the non-zero mode is the same as the weight of the exponential decrease. So that looks like a BPS condition. Whereas if they have opposite sign, it contributes to terms where the exponential fall-off is faster than the phase. So these again look like instanton anti-instanton pairs. I mean, there's a piece which looks like a pure instanton piece with charge n, and then you can get charge n also by having n1 and n2 having opposite signs, where the sum of n1 and n2 is n. That's all I'm going to say about about that function. But I would love some insight into what the meaning is, if any, of these instanton, anti-instanton contributions. So now let me turn to something else, which is taken. So far, everything I've talked about has been in ten dimensions. Now consider compactifying on a torus. Then you get a higher rank. These coefficients now have to be automorphic functions under transformations in this higher rank duality group. The duality groups are in this series, which is called the EN series. The Laplace equations that I had before all generalize, and there's a systematic way of understanding how to get from one dimension to another by starting in the lowest dimension and decompactifying. You work your way up to the 10-dimensional equations I had, and there's a unique set of Laplace equations that these functions have to satisfy for every dimension. So capital D here is the dimension you come down to by compactifying on a torus, a little d torus from 10 dimensions. And these equations have the same structure as before, except now in specific dimensions, highlighted in pink, and actually one in red, there are terms which arise, which happen. The ones in pink coincide with the values of d for which the eigenvalue vanishes. So when the eigenvalue vanishes, there's a sort of anomaly on the right-hand side of these equations. And the dimensions in which the eigenvalues vanish, and therefore this anomaly arises, are precisely the dimensions in which field theory has an ultraviolet divergence. So at one loop, there's a divergence in 8 dimensions. At 2 loops, there's a divergence in 7 dimensions. And at 3 loops, there's a divergence in 6 dimensions in supergravity, as calculated by Byrne et al. And here we have, essentially, because of the duality symmetries, we are required to have these specific coefficients for these delta functions, and they lead, in a way that I may not have time to get to a statement about logarithms that arise in these coefficients, which are counterparts to the logarithms that arise in supergravity in these particular dimensions. But anyway, we want to solve these equations by imposing a number of different boundary conditions. So just like for the SL2 case, you only need to know that the function is polynomial, is of moderate growth at infinity. Here, there is more data that you need to impose to do with different limits that you can take, which I'll mention in a second. But the solutions are generalizations of these Eisenstein series for SL2, and I think I'll just skip over this because I can't possibly talk about these Langlands Eisenstein series in 3 minutes. But there's a natural extension of the Eisenstein series due to Langlands, which applies to these higher rank groups, and we are able to identify the solutions with well, let me just say that there is a parameter S associated with the particular versions of these Eisenstein series that come into our discussion, and this parameter S once more has to take the values either 3/2 or 5/2 for the r to the fourth and d to the fourth r to the fourth cases, and then everything I said before generalizes. But it looks pretty miraculous when you analyze it, because these Eisenstein series generically have far more terms in their constant, in their zero Fourier mode. Remember, the Eisenstein series that we had talked about before had two power behaved terms. Here, the number of power behaved terms grows enormously with the rank of the group. But they can't possibly correspond to terms in string perturbation theory, because they involve powers of the string coupling, which don't arise in string perturbation theory. But what happens is that precisely for these values, S equals 3/2 and S equals 5/2, there's an enormous collapse, enormous numbers of terms vanish, and you get precisely a tree level and one loop piece in any dimension for the r to the fourth term, and a tree level, one loop, and two loop piece for the d to the fourth r to the fourth term. So that these solutions work beautifully, and then there is an analogous statement for the function which satisfies the inhomogeneous equation. So this encodes what is known about string perturbation. All the coefficients come out right. These Eisenstein series, you can analyze their non-perturbative terms, and this answers a question I was asked yesterday. They contain instantons of various types, but these, when you go to these particular series, the 3/2 one contains, and actually was known to contain, the mathematicians had looked at this in a slightly different way, and this contains far fewer orbits of instantons. In fact, this contains just a single orbit corresponding to the half BPS orbit that we expect to have for a half BPS system. So you can look at the instantons that you get, and they correspond precisely to the spectrum of wrapped p-brains that you know you should have in the compactified theory for the half BPS case, and then you get an extra orbit for the quarter BPS case, corresponding to the fact that there are more Euclidean configurations corresponding to quarter BPS instantons. I'm not going to say anything about the next topic because I just haven't got time, but as you decompactify the theory from one dimension to the next, you have to worry about the fact that you're letting R go to infinity, but you're trying to look at the low energy limit, and there's a changeover, there's an interchange of limits that you have to worry about. And that's related to the fact the threshold singularities transform, the nature of the threshold singularity depends on which dimension you're in. But all that works out beautifully. Did I start exactly on time? Oh, that's a pity. Okay, so let me simply go on to point out the following. That if you look at the expressions, now let me go to the critical dimensions I mentioned before. So the critical dimension for the r to the fourth term was 8. That was the dimension in which the eigenvalue in my Laplace equation vanished. In that dimension, you can look at the constant bit, the perturbative piece of the coefficient, and you discover that precisely in that dimension, the highest term in the perturbative piece contains a logarithm of the coupling constant with a particular coefficient. The same is true in 7 dimensions for the d to the fourth r to the fourth term, where again there's a log of the 7-dimensional coupling constant, again with a particular coefficient. And the same is true for the d to the sixth r to the fourth term, where there is a term with a particular coefficient. This coefficient, by the way, has recently changed. These coefficients match precisely with the coefficients that Bern et al. Find by looking at the logarithmic divergences looking at the pole, the residue of the poles in the epsilon expansion in supergravity in these dimensions at one loop, two loops, and three loops. And this is a one loop term, this is a two loop term, this is a three loop term coming out of string theory. And these logs have coefficients which are exactly the same as the ones that they are found in their analysis. So that's slightly tantalizing. I mean, the fantasy is that that the by understanding the duality properties in the string theory, one can understand something about supergravity perturbation theory and its divergences. Well, let me not say goodbye. Let me stop there. Thank you. So, okay, I blanked out a transparency because I didn't think I'd have time, but just in words, these coefficients, the E's, are coefficients in the Einstein frame of the analytic part of the amplitude. But now now imagine that you're really doing string theory, which you do in the string frame, and you have non-analytic pieces of the amplitude, so there'll be a log S that comes in eight dimensions. The genus one amplitude has a logarithmic infrared log S term in string theory. But if you now transform that log S to the Einstein frame, S involves an inverse power of the metric. And so you pick up a power of the dilaton.
Well, that would explain a log G8, but that would also tell us, I think, that there's an undefined constant in this amplitude.
Oh, sorry, I've only put the, I haven't, the, so there's the constant is independent of the moduli.
Okay.
So I haven't put that in, yes, yeah. So if you do the string calculation, of course, there's nothing undefined. You can work out what the scale is. There's a matter of convention where if you rescale S, then you've, of course, redefined the analytic piece.
There's nothing undefined in pure full amplitude.
That's right.
But
that's
what you would call the coefficient of order of the fourth. That's probably what it is.
There is an ambiguity about whether you include, by rescaling S, you can redefine the analytic piece. Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. You can do that. But if you look at the dependence on the moduli, there's no dependence on the moduli that term.
In other words, the coefficient of order of the fourth is well defined up to an ambiguous constant, which is the way I phrased it.
It is, well, in eight dimensions. In 10 dimensions.
I was just discussing the first line.
Yes. Yeah, no, so there should be a scale. I could have put a scale in, which I've arbitrarily chosen to be one in that.
As you described,
yes.
The way we stated naturally is not to claim that there's not a report, but describe the complete amplitude, including the logarithm.
Right, but the coefficient of the logarithm is not ambiguous, and it's that which coincides with the field theory, the coefficient of the logarithm in the field theory. I mean, basically, they're the same logarithm. There's the log S. The coefficient of the log S is determined by unitarity, actually.
Well, I'm confused about how you get this. You get this from the coefficient of modular forms of the appropriate group and D equals
E. Yes, what I should have, I'm sorry, there is a slight misprint there. The E1s should have hats on them because E1 is ES has a pole at S equals 1. So that you regularize the pole, you can subtract the pole, right? So you define a regularized E1.
You're possibly giving us credit for understanding what we're doing.
I see. Okay.
So it's
tantalizingly analogous. The logs arise in a way which is tantalizingly analogous to the way they arise in dimensional regularization. That the Eisenstein series, which I've called E1 there, E1 itself actually is the limit as S goes to 1 of ES, but there's a pole at S equals 1. So you define a regularized series by subtracting the pole, and that leaves you with a logarithm.
But I'm missing the overall picture.
Yeah.
Farther back, you must have had an equation for E8, but naively didn't. If there were no logarithm in the physical entity, you'd have claimed an equation for E8 that, in fact, wouldn't have had a solution. And because the amplitude has an ambiguous constant, or has a logarithm, it makes this thing ambiguous.
So I had this equation. So this equation has this term on the right-hand side, and it's the occurrence of that term, which which is related to the coefficient of the logarithm.
I'm still slightly puzzled. Well, I don't want to keep everyone here with this question. Maybe I should ask you about it. What I'm puzzled about is that to define the art of the four, you had to make a choice of what you did to the log s that was really there in the physical amplitude. And so, yet here you've written an equation that naively has a unique solution.
But the solution has a log.
It has a logarithm, but it has a unique solution. Whereas
you mean the scale of the log?
That equation looks like it would uniquely determine the answer. Whereas, as you've explained in physics,
yes,
there was really an art of the fourth log s. So a recipe was needed before you could define what you meant by the coefficient of art of the fourth. And that recipe really involved a free parameter, which one would think would somehow be in this equation.
The parameter being independent of the moduli.
Yes.
Right.
For d equal 8, that eigenvalue vanishes.
Oh,
yeah, well, so that was the whole point. The whole point was. I didn't realize that. Sorry. I should have said that. Yeah, for all these, that's why they're in pink. They vanish in the critical dimension.
I said this wrong. Right. Anyway, I guess we're asking, but you're
quite right
that your equation then shows for d equal 8. That E is only defined up to an additive constant.
Right, okay.
And what you taught us was that the meaning of that constant was that what you're trying to define was actually not really well defined because there was an art of the fourth log s.
Okay, right.
More questions. You can go to the platform.